Today's topic is 10 questions to consider when preparing for the passing of a loved one. In early January, Karen Brown, a reporter for the New England Public Radio, contributed a heartbreaking op-ed to the New York Times that was published that prior weekend. This was not the good death we were promised, Karen shares. The story of her father's death and how this final time on earth fell short of what he and frankly she expected. I was moved by the piece and contributed a comment to the New York Times op-ed piece, which apparently was picked as one of the New York Times top comments out of 750 comments that were submitted. Less about that our comment was picked as one of the top and more that 750 people took the time to comment broadly about end-of-life care. It moved us, and one of our interns and family friend, Nicole Ernst, who is studying this area, decided to we decided together to have her put together this piece, which is what to do when we're seeking the best end-of-life care. This, the amount of work that has gone into this far exceeds a top 10, 30-minute call that you are all accustomed to here at the firm. And so I would tell you that we're going to post the entire piece on the website. You certainly can call us and ask for a copy of this work as well. We will hit the highlights on it. I cannot emphasize that this is something that is typically outside of the area for certain of estate lawyers. But there is no greater responsibility, we believe, as your advisors, to present to you these important pieces. It has been illuminating for me as well to review the result of the research and the distillation that Nicole, together with our team members, for you. So without further ado, I'm going to first recap what I think is the critical preamble, and that is in this medical field, only 5 out of 125 medical schools in the country offer a course focused on death and dying. It is, of course, significant and a vulnerable point in time, and there is often a competition between the individual's desire to heal and to restore when, frankly, there may not be that opportunity. And the very important need to address end-of-life issues, which would be getting the proper pain management, spending time with family, reminiscing, providing wisdom to children and grandchildren, and leaving them with essential thoughts as we leave this earth. So reminiscing, of course, is one of these most important pieces, but no doubt creating new ones as well. Death itself should not be rushed. And we had a relationship years ago where an individual was terminal and worked, frankly, right till the last 3 or 4 days. It is, and I frankly don't know where I would be without the tutoring of this process that we're all doing now, how long we would give ourselves to embrace what the next part of the continuum of nature is. So first, what we want to do is address what our options are. What is the difference between hospice and palliative care? Number two, do we have our legal documents in order? If you're on this call, you know that we have taken good care of your documents and appointing proper representatives, addressing pain management, timelines for removal of significant interventions that may not have any opportunity to have any remedy for your life. It will be a time, though, to analyze them and say, have you any changes of the thoughts that you had when we originally prepared them? Have discussions, number three, with your loved ones to understand what their wishes are broadly after they pass away, and certainly during the period of time when they're under hospice or palliative care. When do you want end-of-life care to begin? So physicians will determine that hospice care happens in the last 6 months when there is less than 6 months to live. But palliative care, which is something that can take place where people are providing you pain management and comfort, but you're still trying to fight off the illness that has brought you to this point, two separate sets of facts. We want to be clear to research the reputation of the firms or the organizations that would be providing the palliative or hospice care, both in-house, where you would be, your loved ones or we would be going ourselves, or whether they're at our own homes. So essential on this is to do that homework. And one of those essential pieces to be doing as we're addressing the stage in life, and what is the reputation of pain management? How are the employees viewed online by loved ones, and how they're treating our loved ones? Find out who the medical care providers are, who is behind that mask, and what is their care. Once we move into hospice, our ordinary physicians will no longer be the typical reporting physicians. They'll be those that will be focused on your pain management and care through the end of your life. And so we want to assure that as we move from our tried and true medical care providers, are we pleased with the ones who are stepping in? Do your due diligence. So have you explored all factors, and do you understand completely the choices of palliative versus hospice care? Are you pleased, even once you've made a decision where you are, that this is a place that you should be, and are your loved ones? So this exercise that we go through here is for us individually, but equally for our loved ones to know, for when you're acting, each of you on the call and all of our clients at McManus & Associates, are you giving your loved ones that proper care as well? And then finally, which is better, in-house or out-house? Should you be in someone's, in an organized place, or should you be at home? What happens if things don't work perfectly? Do you have a backup? And would you consider counseling, number 10? So who would think that you'd have pre-mortem counseling? But wouldn't that be wonderful? It is a draining, draining time. We were recently at a fundraiser, and one of the charities that this fundraiser focuses on is the care providers. How draining it is if you are the one that is assisting somebody in need, and the time that you take. So more research that you have to have assistance helping you, and to feel comfort that your loved one is in the best possible place. So first, number one is the difference between hospice and palliative. We've spoken about it. Hospice doctors have to agree that the patient is within the last 6 months of their life, and that life-sustaining treatment has stopped. Since there is no longer life-sustaining treatment, the focus is on pain and symptom management. It serves as an alternative to active treatment. Active treatment would still continue under palliative care, where this can start any time after we've diagnosed that there is an illness which will ultimately likely result in one passing away, but it doesn't mean that we're not continuing life-sustaining treatment going forward, because it could be years in this instance. So palliative care would still focus on pain and symptom management, but there is still active treatment taking place. So two different pieces. One is focused for certain on a greater than 6 month timeline and not a clear knowing when someone is going to pass away. Number two, the legal documents in order, the three that we have put together for you always are your healthcare directive, your living will, and your HIPAA document. Healthcare directive, when you've named people to act on your behalf, they would be the agents assuring that you have the best care. You have alternates in those documents. You give your agents the opportunity to speak with doctors directly to get your medical records. Your living will talks about donating organs, when you would want life support to end, what timelines you're wishing, what kinds of quote-unquote heroic measures you would want. And then HIPAA, which is the release of medical information, your information, you want to authorize third parties to act on your behalf, your loved ones, so that they can see your medical history and help participate in the decision-making process. It is essential, and we've done this for you already, but that to can always consider revising and amending this, or at least reviewing it, and part of your work with us is that every 2 years or so, we're expecting either we're going to reach you or you reach us, if moved by the spirit, to get to us and just recap what we've put in place for you on your medical documents and make sure we're current. Number three, have you had a discussion with your loved one to understand what their wishes are? Your loved one should be always feel that they're in control of their own passing away, and they should know what this means for them. When the time comes and they're no longer mentally competent to make decisions, the surrogate should step in and be their voice. And that's where you are when you're serving as agents for your loved ones or where your agents are for you. If you are the surrogate decision maker, keep in mind this profoundly important delegation bestowed on you, and to always step into the shoes of your loved one. Not easy to do, number one. Number two is it can be riddled with guilt and second guessing, but you owe it to yourself to say, these are not my decisions, these are the ones that my loved one wants me to do, and to try your best to understand you're merely an instrument of the decisions your loved one has given you the ability to make for them, and that less about whether you feel you're making the right decision. Okay, next on the list is number four, and that is when should your loved one want end-of-life care to begin? We've talked about whether this is palliative or whether this is hospice. The struggle will consistently be whether the patients are fighting their illness and do not want to receive end-of-life care until they're done receiving preventative treatment. This can minimize. We applaud everyone's always hope against hope and through prayers of miracles and so forth, but the equal competition here is that it can minimize the benefits of end-of-life care as they have this less time to prepare for their passing. For certain eligible for hospice care means 6 months of life. But many may say, I'm not prepared to go from active treatment to hospice because I still believe there is hope. If they want to continue to receive preventive treatment, then, of course, palliative care may be a better option. I personally feel that as we become more sophisticated in this area of life, as some cultures and societies have become, and communities, that will be able to be more discerning about whether we want palliative care or we want to move directly to hospice. It is essential, though, to consider the import of both. So number five, have you learned all of the potential facilities that you're considering? Just like restaurants, hotels, vacation packages, facilities for hospitals, facilities for nursing and assisted living, and now even for palliative care and hospice are not all the same. See that they provide quality care and do not have a history of promising services which were not delivered. It is important to do your research, and when you do, you'll find your list of what to look out for at the place you ultimately discern you want to go to or your loved ones you want to put in, but also you'll have your backup so that should you need to rally and make a transfer, you've already done your work. And so you know more about what Plan B is. More on that through this call. You certainly want to ask, do they have a history of withholding pain medication from patients due to fear of addiction? This it will be, and if you have not experienced this, certainly we all have in this firm seen situations where loved ones are battling like heck to get more pain relief through morphine and other pain relief medicines, but there is a social underlying factor here at these hospitals and palliative care and so forth centers where they're concerned about addiction. You will hear people screaming, why are we worried about an addiction when my loved one is leaving this earth? And some of it has to do with, are we creating death sooner because there's too much of a drug being administered? We cannot emphasize enough that at least the questions need to be asked, and you should research online how this care center is handling your matters. Do they have a history of ethical or staff issues? Ask when the last time the facility was inspected by the state or federal government. They should tell you if there are any issues. Be sure, of course, that they are resolved. This work here is done up front, but will serve you well for yourself and for your loved ones afterwards. Number six, how well do you know your loved one's healthcare providers? So as we know, few medical professionals have explicit training in this death and dying process. Talking to your loved one's doctor may help form a more personal relationship and make your loved one feel more comfortable. But learning about the communication habits between the doctor and their colleagues is extremely important. You want to be reassured that everyone coming and going knows what has to be done before they arrived and why. The reputation of those on the staff is important. Know whether anyone has a history of withholding pain medication. We've spoken about this because of the fear of doctors and nurses giving too much pain relief and addiction. When the goal of end-of-life care is to provide comfort, have staff with a reputation of withholding pain medication is an important concern. So some facilities use volunteer services who interact with the patient and families to do the screening. So think about volunteers and screening. It is a very important point. When you have loved ones in these facilities and they're there for 6 months or 12 months, you cannot be there all the time. And one of the most stressful things you'll experience if you haven't heard from others is finding out that your loved one is in extreme pain. And now you're trying to undo that. Your loved one or you is in a situation where they become dramatically vulnerable. You would be doing this research for your 6 month, 12 month, 4-year-old child, making sure that when you're not there, you know that the child care center is treating them well. This is no different than that because these are our most vulnerable, fragile people, and we need to know that when we're not there, just like with children, that they are performing to the level that they promise they are and that we expect them to perform. So as you reach that, have you asked these questions that could influence your decision? So be sure that you're well-informed and you're ready to move on to other places. So you have that option to move from where you currently are. So as we discuss now whether or not you should be an inpatient at a facility or whether you should be with family, the physical location for end-of-life care is always significant. It's important that they feel comfortable in their environment during the final days of their life. Unfortunately, this is not always possible. Some families may not be physically equipped to care for loved ones. It is, you know, we have stories of taking the first floor and converting it to the dining room into a bedroom or the living room into a bedroom. It is an amazing undertaking for the whole family. Some families may not be physically equipped to do that, and some also are not financially able to allow their families to stay in a facility. So you have to balance the costs and the benefits, financial costs, emotional costs, choosing each versus the other. What are the pros? If you're outpatient, your loved one receives individual and specialized attention. You're there, if not every hour, you have help. You're there multiple times during the day. They're familiar with this environment, and this could provide emotional and psychological benefits. And the loved one is able to spend unrestricted time with family members as they please. It seems in many respects that it is ideal. What are the cons? Family members will be completely relied on for help. They will be expected to help loved ones eat, move, use the bathroom, practice personal hygiene. Family members must be physical and well enough to do this and more. If there is an emergency, there's a chance that your loved one will not receive help in time. And, of course, after your loved one passes away, the memories of final days will remain in the home because now your loved one will leave that space, and this could be a very, very significant hole in your, not only your heart, but in your home if you live there and now your loved one has passed away. If you're inpatient, the pros are that you're around the clock, supervision and staff, even for those of you who put your loved ones in nursing homes. We can tell you patients who have fallen twice in 12 months and broken their hip twice in that period when at home, and now 2.5 years later, they're in assisted living and there has never been one incident. So clearly, assisted living is one example of having professionals around. There is immediate access to pain relief and medication and attention in the event of an emergency. Family members can continue to go to work and maintain some type of normal routine. And after your loved one dies, you can physically leave the place where they passed. So there's that disconnect there that is not as relevant when they're in a facility, and that you can have a separate life during this period of time. What are the cons? With an on-site staff that rotates on shifts, some family members feel that the staff is not personally caring about your loved one. This happens at nursing homes, at assisted living facilities, certainly at hospitals, and why would we think that palliative or hospice care could be any different? Research, and do your best. Patients will be in an unfamiliar setting, and they will not receive the psychological or emotional benefits of being at home. So essential to think about those pieces. It may be a strain, and so you'll want to consider photos and easels with family photos and videos that you all can have work an environment that looks closer to a recognized one than otherwise in a palliative care center. And last is loved ones are not surrounded daily by family and friends as they please. They will be able to visit, but there are hours, and certainly it's not the same as being in the neighborhood. Number 9, do you have a backup plan, and have you asked care providers to tell you what they can do to help? This is more important for those who've decided to use outpatient care, but always keep this in mind that you may, despite what promises, you may have to move. Recent stories have been publicized drawing attention to negative hospice and palliative care experiences. This has ranged from poor communication to not delivering on promises made by the organization. A common reoccurrence is that help does not show up on time and staff is not attentive or sensitive to patients who are in pain and the loved ones, doctors and nurses could not be reached. This is the piece in the New York Times. And separately, we have instances where we've heard of clients able to get enough strength to get to the toilet and then and not be able to be picked up because they switched shifts and being on the toilet for 2 hours or 3 hours or being in bed and the shift missing and not being taken out of bed for 3 hours. All of these things happen more frequently in a less well-managed palliative or hospice, but nonetheless happen, and there it is critical to just keep important tabs on this essential period of time. If we, again, look at this, how we would be ruthless in our seeking to correct an issue if it was our child that was not being treated well as a 6 month or 1 year or 5 year old. Certainly we have to presume at the end of life it is the same for our loved ones. So we want to ask for loved ones providers and who will be available to give from that group of providers pain relief so that we don't just have one name but we have multiples. It is not only excruciatingly unfair and unreasonable and inappropriate and immoral to have somebody suffering with pain at the end of their life. Imagine what it is for loved ones like you all to not be in a position to do anything during this period. So pain management and knowing that you have backup could not be more important. We were recently on with a client who is a physician, and her comment was, we can't think one day, and it wasn't necessarily about end of life, but we can't just solve for today. We have to solve for today, tomorrow, a week, 2 weeks in advance. And when you think that way and anticipate that this checklist provides and asking for your backup and what happens with shift removal and how are you addressing pain relief, you are doing angelic work for your loved one. It will make you feel better that you've done what's absolutely best. And this time period is fraught with emotion anyway. You're losing your loved one. You're in the mourning process. You may even have unresolved matters that have happened over the course of a lifetime. So you want to walk away from this period with the greatest degree of, I did everything I could, you know, in these final weeks, months, days, and take that confidence, which leads us to the last piece, counseling. So this is a stressful process. We always hear about grief counseling. It is normally at the after this person passes away. But as I spoke earlier on this call, it is a time of extraordinary stress and on the care providers and the family. And yet they will often not address that and say, how am I entitled to relief or massages or a 5-day vacation when the most important loved one in our family is terminal? And the answer is that is an unfair assessment that they should be doing to themselves. It doesn't mean that any of us can reconcile that, but having counseling enables us to have professionals who are far more experienced with us in this role of care providers to help us not just with the mourning process that happens after our loved one passes away, but actually before our loved one passes away. It will enable us to also have a richer experience and a more memorable one rather than one which is fraught with sadness and with guilt and more with a time to reminisce and to embrace this as a rich period. So terminal diagnosis and facing death, people will have different reactions, and we can't assure that any of the people that we're caring for and our family will follow our lead and allow us to help them. But in the end here, we can only address our own emotions and how we're dealing with this. And so having counseling is not an immaterial consideration here. Rituals after death, such as the funeral and the memorial service and even traditions are helpful. And they serve as a distraction immediately when we're losing our loved one and an opportunity to celebrate. But even the counseling after one passes away, when the ritual period is ended and we don't have those distractions, you've always heard these stories. That is the tough time. A week or 2 weeks later, when we're all alone at home. My father is notorious for that after we've gone to funerals and say, you know, this is a time when there are family and there's dinners and so forth, but it's the 2 weeks from now that I pray for this family. So it is important to build that social system as the care provider, starting while your loved one is alive and continuing it as long as you possibly can. You owe it to yourself. You've earned and you deserve the right to both mourn and then to elevate from that. This is what your loved ones would want, that you to grow from that.